ancestor Dogen says, "My Zen pilgrimage took me to the land of Sung, Dynasty China, where in the autumn of the 16th year of Chia Tung, the year we would call 1223, Dogen was 23 years old, having landed in China, and at this time practicing at Tian Tung Monastery with his teacher. I first visited Guangli Zen Temple on Mount Aiyuan. Aiyuan Shan Temple in, means King Ashoka Temple, named after the great Indian king who spread Buddha Dharma throughout India. Very benevolent king, made based on his understanding of Buddha Dharma, created all kinds of services for the homeless in India. Kind of rest stops where homeless people could stay, and also animal shelters. And really just, you know, Buddhism was just a few centuries after the Buddha lived, but it wasn't yet like, it was still a new movement, but when the king said, "This is great, let's widely promote this way," the Buddha's Dharma spread widely throughout India at that time. He was a great king, Ashoka. So for some reason, this Chinese temple is named after him. And it's down the road from Tian Tung. You may recall that the Tenzo who sold some mushrooms to Dogen when Dogen was on the ship was from Mount Aiyuan. And I visited these temples myself in China. I was actually practicing at Tian Tung, where they have, maybe it was like a practice period, something, but it was sort of like, it seemed like ongoing kind of sesshin. I don't think it was like a 7-day thing. I think this was just their daily schedule, which was very impressive because Buddhism is, this was in 2000 when I was there. You know, the Cultural Revolution, not so long before, almost wiped out Buddhism in China. Like it was almost wiped out many times before in its thousands of years of history. But Buddha Dharma cannot be stopped. The government can't stop practice. It tries, and it can destroy lots of temples and kill lots of practitioners, but it just sprouts up again. So this temple, because it was a Tian Tung, is a mountain monastery, not so close to the big cities. Maybe for that reason in particular, it was really thriving. Lots of young monks, like in their 20s and 30s, some of which had heard about Zen in America and asked a little bit about it. Almost nobody spoke English. So they had it was like here, just sitting and walking meditation, tea in the zendo, silent meals in a dining hall. And I just kind of, they were very welcoming. I could just join their practice for a week or something. And the beautiful thing is, you know, I don't know any Chinese, and I think there was one young monk who knew a little bit of English out of hundreds and hundreds of people living there. But it didn't matter, because it's just zazen, right?
Ding.
Ding. Yeah. Exactly. Zazen, Qinhin. They do fast walking around and around the central altar. Beautiful to join them and feel that, like, that universal spirit of Zen practice, just in a completely different land where it came from. And anyway, one day I knew about this temple, Ayuangshan, that was nearby. I think it was like a little bus trip. I think you could walk, but it was maybe a few miles, but close, same town, King Ashoka Temple. And it's known for this Buddha relic that lives there. And Dogen mentions that too, so that's kind of amazing to me that 800 years before it was also known for this Buddha relic, and it's still there, and people still go to see it. So timeless. Buddha relics are like, you know, maybe not exactly like a bone, but I think more technically speaking, sharira is the Sanskrit name for relics, are more like transformed bones that great practice not only transforms the mind and the posture and so on, but it transforms the inner bones, turning them into like bright crystal beads, various forms you can, you know, this is pretty much every Buddhist country has some tradition of honoring relics, not just of the Buddha, but of also great practitioners. So, but this was supposedly a sharira, or transformed bit of body of Shakyamuni Buddha. And there was a whole relic hall there with big kind of like altar thing that very ornate structure that housed another box, and within that box there was another box and another box, and all the way down in that center there's this little relic box. And I was with this group of Chinese tourists. It's kind of like one of these things, if you're on pilgrimage, a tourist thing, right? You go and see the relics at this place particular, this temple. So this long line where they get everybody chanting homage to Shakyamuni Buddha over and over, and the anticipation builds and builds as the line moves towards the room where one of the monks from the temple is holding this reliquary box with the relic inside it, with white gloves, so as not to even touch the box with his oily hands. And we get in there, and then you come up in line, and he's holding this thing, and it's got this tiny little like opening in the bottom, and I think he maybe even had like a flashlight or something. And you have to, homage to Shakyamuni Buddha, homage to Shakyamuni Buddha. You have to kind of lean down underneath and look up through the hole. And there it is, dangling in space, the Buddha relic. Awesome. Yes.
Is this the same as like what I've heard described as the pearls or crystals of great practitioners? It's kind
yeah.
of Taoist.
Yeah, it might be a Tao, might be Taoist too.
Where, like, if there's a cremation,
yes.
And then there's, you know, yeah. there's these relics.
Yeah, in the ashes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, like pearls or crystals, and you can, you know, see pictures of all different types, and it's hard to say what these, you know. I mean, I don't think people just went and bought some pearls and put them in a thing because there's many people involved, and it's usually, you know, at the cremation of a great being, everyone gets excited to rummage through the ashes to look for these. Things and sometimes there's relic tours in America where they bring, there's one a couple years ago in San Jose where they have like a kind of a moving show of relics. But and at City of 10,000 Buddhas, their abbot, Venerable Master Hua, there's a whole relic hall there where you can go see the actual yeah, these brightly colored, smooth beads that you usually wouldn't find in a cremation ashes, right? Very strange, unless the person ate them just before they died or something. So, I don't know, but I think that the function of honoring Buddha relics in all these different countries is... to increase faith. And you, even if you say it's all a sham, it does seem to have the function of arousing faith in devoted people. Maybe the serious practitioners are like, oh, we don't actually need that faith, we just let's just practice and make our own relics. But I think it's in the same way that going on pilgrimage in India for me was a very like faith inspiring event, to just walk to these places where the Buddha walked. Like it wasn't just a kind of mythological being, there was like this human being that lived in these places, and here's what they looked like. You know, they still look like, but often what they looked like at that time is very rural, ancient villages. And so maybe that's something about if you at least imagine that this is a physical manifestation of Shakyamuni Buddha's Buddha nature, then it's something tangible. It's not just like a painting of a round moon. We want to see like eyebrows raising and eyes blinking. We want to look through that hole and see something dangling in space that we can't quite touch, but we could if that guy would let us. Anyway, Dogen was staying at Tiantong and went to Aiwangshan to visit, see the relics, and check out the practitioners there in his with his 23-year-old confidence. While I was there, I saw painted on the walls of the western corridor in the main hall transformed images of the 33 ancestors of India and China. I don't recall that. I think I actually looked because I knew of this story when I was there. Like looked for the. So I wonder if there's still paintings of the ancestors, but there weren't. The 33 ancestors from Shakyamuni Buddha through the sixth ancestor of China were painted all along a corridor. At that time, I did not comprehend them. Later in the first year of Bao Jing, 1225, during this 2 years later, during the summer practice period, I visited that temple again. As I was walking along the corridor with Chung Gui of Shu, the guest master at the monastery, the Shika, I came before the image of Nagarjuna in that row of ancestors. I asked Chung Gui, what transformation is depicted here? That's Nagarjuna bodily manifesting a moon-like shape, he answered. And I was looking for a picture. I think I've actually seen a picture somewhere where people still sometimes, because of the story of Nagarjuna in Zen, manifesting the round moon shape. You see these paintings of all these human beings that maybe have particular things that are connected with their stories. But when you get to the picture of Nagarjuna, there's maybe a seat or a cushion, and it's just a round moon picture instead of a person. Right? They're walking along, look at their ancestors, Dogen's like, what's up with that one? It's just a round, empty circle. And Chung Gui says, don't you know, young man from a foreign country? That's Nagarjuna manifesting the moon-like shape. Haven't you heard about his Buddha nature manifesting in such a way? I'm adding in a little here. And then Dogen says, but the nose holes in the face that uttered those words were drawing no breath. The words themselves were hollow in his mouth. You know, in Zen we talk about nostrils. The nostrils of the patriarch monks are like their life source. They're like, you know, their true spontaneous authentic life energy is their nostrils, because that's where the life breath comes in and out. And also it's like if someone, and they sometimes, you know, they would call monks a set of nostrils because they're like, they're empty space too. I don't know how this came to be that they call them that. But it just occurs to me. I never heard anybody say this, but in Japanese, nose holes or nostrils is pronounced bhikkhu. And also the name of a monk is pronounced bhikkhu. Maybe it's playing with the homonym. But the nostrils in the face that uttered those words were drawing no breath. The life force wasn't coming through. This is Dogen's poetic criticism. Zen-style criticism. So the monk said, that's Nagarjuna bodily manifesting a moonlight shape. Yes, indeed, I said, just like a picture of a rice cake, isn't it? Remember that painting or picture of a rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. That's this Zen saying that painted rice cakes are just conceptual ideas. We have to actually eat real rice cakes to satisfy our bodhicitta hunger. So Dogen's just kind of sparring with him here in Zen style. That's Nagarjuna manifesting the moon shape, and Dogen says, looks just like a picture of a rice cake to me. In other words, it's kind of a criticism of this picture. Both the fact that it looks like a round white rice cake and it doesn't satisfy my hunger, thank you. And the monk laughed loudly at that. He kind of like, nice Zen sparring. But Dogen says, there was no edge to his laugh, or there was no sword or knife in his laugh. This is another Zen saying that because laughter actually comes up in these Zen stories quite often, and it's often like either somebody just has some awakening and they laugh, or somebody laughs and then somebody else has an awakening. So laughter plays a role in communicating Zen, unlike maybe any other Buddhist or other tradition. Maybe Sufism has some laughter. But they say when there's a sword in the laugh, it's like a laugh that really cuts through delusion. It's like a, you know, an awakening laugh has a sword, Manjushri's sword in the laugh. So Dogen says here, that monk laughed loudly, but there was no sword in his laugh. It could not even have cut through a painted rice cake. Like maybe there was like a really dull plastic butter knife in his laugh, but it couldn't have cut through a painted rice cake. Not to mention a real rice cake. Well, we proceeded to the relic hall and to the six famous sites of the monastery. I brought the subject up several more times, but Chung Wei showed no sign that he had any doubts about it. He didn't have any problem with this painted moon. Several other monks ventured opinions as well, but their comments too were totally off the mark. And Dogen's, you know, not going to just let this go, of course. He's so passionate about clarifying Dharma, right? He's asking all of them, what's with this picture of Nagarjuna painted as the moon? And so Dogen says, let's go ask the head priest about it. I said, the head priest at that time was Ta Kuang. He has no nostrils, replied Chung Wei. It's kind of rude, Shika, talking about like the abbot of the place. Don't bother asking him, he has no nostrils. He couldn't give you an answer. What could you learn from him? So therefore, I did not ask Ta Kuang after all. And Brother Kuei himself, despite the way he spoke, did not understand either. None of the monks who heard our discussion were able to venture any utterance. Past generations of head priests at Mount Aiwang who have gazed at this picture must not have harbored any doubts about it, for they had not changed it. So all the years that this picture was there, nobody questioned it or wanted to change it, so none of them understood, Dogen is saying. Things that are undepictable are best left unpainted, Dogen says. If they must be painted at all, they can only be painted straight to the point, or painted authentically. Yet the body manifesting the shape of the round moon has never yet been painted. So, Nagarjuna's formless samadhi, his signless samadhi manifesting the round moon shape. These artists tried to paint it. Maybe they felt like, well, we can't just paint Nagarjuna's body because, as the story of Nagarjuna said, no one could see him at that time in his formless samadhi. So let's, if you know, we don't want to skip the ancestor in this line of ancestors, so let's just paint it as a round moon shape. But Dogen's saying, don't paint something that can't be painted. Even to paint it as your idea of a round moon that looks like a painted rice cake, is off the mark, is not authentic. Any concept or idea we have of what this formless samadhi, round moon shape manifestation looks like is just our idea of what it looks like. Dogen says, yet the body manifesting the shape of the round moon has never yet been painted. Because they have not awakened from the mistaken view that the Buddha nature is identical to their present perceptions and discriminations, they are depriving themselves of a gateway through which to penetrate either the words Buddha nature or the words no Buddha nature. the mistaken view is that Buddha nature is identical to our present perceptions and discriminations. Remembering that Buddha nature can manifest as many things. Eyes blinking, eyebrows raising, moon shapes, sun, moon, and stars, earth, land, and oceans, and walls, tiles, and pebbles can all be manifestations of Buddha nature, and yet Buddha nature is not identical to our present perceptions and discriminations. Not identical to our discriminating mind. To say that, yeah, this mind and my thinking right now, that's Buddha nature. We might have started to think that, right? Dogen says, no, these are not identical. Those who are even being taught that they must make some utterance about this are few and far between, or they must make some expression about this. It's that word, Dotoku, which is the name of another Shobogenzo fascicle, meaning complete expression. So, practitioners these days are not even being encouraged to say something about Buddha nature. You should know that this state of neglect stems from a corruption that's almost beyond hope of recovery. Everywhere you go, there are head priests who pass their entire lifetimes without once uttering the words Buddha nature. Can you believe it? In other words, this is a really important issue we need to talk about and express. Some of them say, a person who only listens to Dharma teaching may talk about Buddha nature, but not a patro monk who's engaged in Zen practice. They don't need to talk about Buddha nature. In other words, the people in the kind of scholastic traditions that are trying to clarify all these traditional teachings like Tathagata Garbha and Buddha nature, they may talk about it, but literally it's, here it says a monk, but it's unno, which means literally cloud patches, another poetic name for patro monks. They're like flowing clouds wearing patches, or cloud patches. Their robes patched together from clouds. Those Zen people, they shouldn't talk about Buddha nature, because maybe they shouldn't talk about anything. They should just sit, face the wall. Some people say this. But such people are no different from beasts. A pack of devils who strayed into our way are the Buddha Tathagatas and defile it. Dogen getting riled up. Because, as you know, Dogen, even though he's so into just wholeheartedly sit, words don't reach it. He was so into expressing over and over volumes and volumes of words. We can't be complacent about not clarifying Buddha nature and no Buddha nature. Dogen says, is there only listening to Dharma teaching? Or is there only something called listening to Dharma teaching in the Buddha way? Is there something called engaging in wholehearted Zen practice in the Buddha way? In other words, let's not make these distinctions between here's these people that are like the scholastic expounders of teaching, and here's the people practicing zazen. You must realize that in the Buddha way, distinctions between listening to Buddha's teaching and practicing Zen have never existed. That's a nice statement that supports having Dharma talks and classes in a Zen center. Right? You must realize the Buddha way, in the Buddha way, distinctions between listening to Buddha's teaching and practicing Zen have never existed. In other words, it's not just sitting silently. Now Dogen will let this story go after several pages of commenting on Nagarjuna's round moon and move on to another story where national teacher Jir An of Hangzhou in Yen Quan Xian, a distinguished priest and disciple of Matsu, once taught his disciples, "All sentient beings have Buddha nature." That's a new one, huh? That's what the Buddha said, too. And there's some, you know, longer context it's in, but Dogen only quotes this part here. He's saying basically, just like the Buddha taught, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. But here, Dogen's comment is, the words, "all sentient beings," should be penetrated forthwith. I can bring up another aspect here. All sentient beings have Buddha nature, but let's stop and take a look at all sentient beings. The inner and external karma of sentient beings is not the same. Their views, their ways of viewing things are different. Sentient beings have different types of karma and karmic tendencies, different types of views. There are unenlightened, non-Buddhist adherents of the three vehicles, five vehicles, and so forth. I think he would mean there's people outside of Buddha Dharma, and then within Buddha Dharma there are the three vehicles of Shravakas, Prateka Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, different types of practice in small and greater vehicles. And if you add in humans and devas, that makes five. As for all sentient beings, in the Buddha way, all things possessed of mind are called sentient beings, because mind is, as such, sentient being. So that's a pretty standard definition of sentient beings. That's what we mean by sentient beings. Shujo, or living beings, means all things possessed of mind. That's our standard definition. That's how we distinguish a sentient being over a non-sentient being. Sentient beings are, as such, mind. Oh no, let's see. Things possessed of mind are called sentient beings because mind, as such, is sentient being. Things not possessed of mind are also sentient beings because sentient beings are, as such, mind. So there, that's something new. Not the usual understanding. Things not possessed of mind are also sentient beings because sentient beings are, as such, mind. And I don't know exactly how the original language plays this out, but my understanding here, and the reason I thought to bring up this paragraph, is because I think it's a beautiful way of talking about this issue of what about, you know, that rocks, tiles, and pebbles have Buddha nature. And I think I mentioned this some point previously, but my own sort of take on this, and now I hear Dogen saying this, and maybe it's my own take on what Dogen's saying, But I hear this as a kind of way to understand how it is that all these so-called non-sentient beings are actually sentient in a way and have Buddha nature, or have Buddha nature, or are Buddha nature, or are expressing and manifesting Buddha nature, which is a kind of blending together of the Tathagatagarbha Buddha nature teachings and the Chittamatra or mind only teachings. And as most of us have heard many times, the way that that these phenomena around us, we say, are mind only. That's the mind only teaching. And the simple way to say that is, when we see things and experience things, we're experiencing not the thing in and of itself. We're experiencing it through the lens of our perception, right? Our mind. We can't escape this fact, right? We can't get at this watch as an object apart from mind. Even if there were the watch as an object apart from mind, we would never know such a thing, right? Because we only know it through our mind. That's the basic, simple version of mind only. Pretty straightforward. I mean, it's kind of hard to argue that. But it's also, even though it's pretty straightforward when we think about it, everything we're perceiving and experiencing is through our experience, through our mind, and its experience and its way of perceiving and conceiving the world, even in both in direct perception and in conceptual elaboration. It's all filtered through mind and sensory organs of the mind. Straightforward, and yet I think it's so amazing because we hardly ever think that way. Even though we might know that, when we see this watch, we're like, I'm going to pick up the watch. We don't think like, I'm picking up my mind's version of the watch, right? So this is worth contemplating again and again. And how, maybe Sashin's a nice place too, to really start noticing how everything we're experiencing is through this filter or lens of our mind. And therefore, do we relate to it differently? I mean, I usually just pick up the watch just as an object apart from mind that I think is really out here. But to start opening to, it's like a mind picking up an aspect of mind. It's just like the experience feels a little different. It's a little more like a dream. Like in a dream, particularly if you happen to notice that you're in a dream, you're interacting with objects, but you know they're completely created by mind. So I can even, if I start to look at my watch and the hand and the whole room opening to this perspective, it starts to feel a little bit more like a dream. Like I can still feel like, well, there's some basis that the dream is being overlaid on of the things in the room, but we're all experiencing them a little differently. So in that way, that's how I'm interpreting Dogen's connection here, is that non-sentient beings are in fact sentient. How does he say it? Things not possessed of mind are also sentient beings. Not possessed of mind. So the watch, when we say mind only, we don't mean that the watch has a mind or is a mind, is possessed of a mind. The watch does not have a mind. But we could say our version of the watch is a kind of sentient version, because it's our minds. We're a sentient being, and our perception of it, we're almost like, if we look closely, this is a kind of living, sentient experience of an inanimate object. Does that make sense? Yes.
No.
No?
You know, I'm wondering here if the translation from Chinese to Japanese is labored by English.
But can you see this point?
What do I see?
Mm-hmm.
What I see is maybe a difference in English between sentient and sensate. I mean, that stimulates the mind. That, whatever that thing is, we call it watch, stimulates the mind, stimulates discrimination, stimulates Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm.
And one might say that Buddha nature does not exist apart from the stimulation. And that which is stimulating is not really visible. What's visible is the stimulation of our mind. In that sense, I could say it's sensate. But not sentient. I don't see how that is feeling.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Possession of mind. It's possessed of mind.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's a stretch in the words.
Yeah.
I think literally maybe it's a better to say living being. And literally shu means like the assembly or group, and jo means life or living. So sentient being, what we translate as sentient being, is more literally translated as the group of the living, or sentient beings is the assembly of the living, literally. So,
including grass?
Well, in this interpretation, this is Zen, right? So this is Dogen doing Dogen's thing. So he's saying, things not possessed of mind are also, this says sentient beings, but we could say things not possessed of mind are also the realm of the living, because this is not possessed of mind. Yeah, if you mean, does this start having sensations? No, the watch does not have sensations. So maybe that's a good way to, if we translate it as, it's brought alive because we're alive. We're a living being, and so we, our experience of the watch then makes this watch, that's our experience of the watch, is kind of, it depends on our life, and it's in a way, it is alive. It's only, it's an object of us as a living being, but that makes it living. The experience of the watch is a living experience, and that's the only watch we'll ever know and love. Is the experienced watch, which
so
is
the imputation of utility in this case makes it alive,
or even that's part of it, but also the imputation that it's a watch, even, or that it, we don't even if we don't know what it is, we just see some like dark object on the ground, even that makes it, it's alive as soon as we see it or experience it in any way. Yes. Yeah, we're kind of in the midst of that now. So this is the Chittamatra, the mind-only thing, is that everything we experience is kind of a projection of mind, and that makes everything that seems like objects apart from mind are actually mind. That's Chittamatra. And then combining it with Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature, is, which those traditions are often interwoven, like the Lankavatara Sutra is all about Buddha nature and Chittamatra. But we could say, because Buddha nature, Tathagata Garbha, is about mind, so it's the nature of mind. Buddha nature is the actual nature of mind, which is like our mind that's aware of a world and this dualistic way. The nature of this dualistic experience is non-dual, empty, clear awareness that we call Buddha nature. So therefore, we could say that every dualistic thought and experience we have, the nature of that dualistic thought and experience, we could say is Buddha nature. Does that make sense? So therefore, we're having a dualistic experience of me and the watch. I see it's a projection of mind, and it really appears to be outside the mind. And now I see, so now it's become kind of alive. It's a mind object. And because it's a mind object, and if the nature of our mind is Buddha nature, then the nature of this mind watch is Buddha nature. You follow that? I feel like though it might sound like it's playing with words or something, but I can actually... It's very subtle. But, it's a little bit like saying, we already say, even outside of mind only, we would say the nature of the watch is emptiness. The true nature of this appearance of a watch is emptiness. All Mahayana traditions would agree with that. But in the mind-only tradition, we say the particular type of emptiness it is. They usually don't talk this way. Usually, this is not in the sutras, right? Although I did have a conversation with a Tibetan teacher very similar to this, where we were talking about dualistic experiences, and he's saying that, they use that word rigpa, which means non-dual awareness, and it's really a synonym of Buddha nature. It's in many places said to be, it means Buddha nature. And he's saying that everything, we're experiencing the room right now, and you can experience it as a kind of what is the word that was used, shining forth, or expression. I think that was the word, expression rigpa. So if we say Buddha nature, it's like this expression of the room right now is actually, and everything that we see is expression Buddha nature. And that was, I was like, well, how, I don't understand this. How can this be? It sounds neat, but and through this conversation, basically I asked something like what we're talking about now, and this one teacher anyway did confirm that, yeah, that's what we mean. The objects we perceive are like mental projections, and the nature of them is like the Buddha nature. Yes.
It's really hard to grasp. It's almost like it's just a little bit out of reach.
Yeah.
And
it's impossible to grasp completely.
And that's one part of it. The other part feels like Buddha nature becomes a verb rather than a noun.
Hmm.
And it becomes an activity rather than an object. The activity of watching the mind and the nature of the mind.
Yeah. Well, the nature would never be really an object, although it's sometimes presented in a more kind of static way. But when we say the true nature of things, we're talking about an empty awareness, which is not a kind of static, fixed, graspable thing. It's, you could, in a way, activity, but not even our usual activity, more like, but it's dynamic, and it's not static, and it's alive.
Process.
In a way, you could say we are Buddha naturing everything. As soon as we see the watch, when we don't see the watch, in a way, we could say, it doesn't have Buddha nature, right? It doesn't actually exist. If we see it or even think of it, then our mind has projected a watch, and therefore the nature of that movement of projection, you could say that the nature is also moving and is empty, of everything we say about it. It's another way to talk about it. It's not some thing. It's like, you could even say, we perceive the watch and we see that it's a mental projection, and then the way that it's actually empty of being an external watch is its Buddha nature. And that's you could say in a way that's changing all the time, because now it's over here, that's a different one. Now it's here. Now every time it moves slightly, you get a different location of the emptiness of the external watch. So that's another kind of twist when we start to make Buddha nature into something. We see what we're talking about is the empty nature of the projection. And that's why Dogen's constantly going back and forth between Buddha nature and Mu Busho, or no Buddha nature. And there's another piece that's going to bring that out soon too.
Piggybacking on these insight, light is not visible, but what it excites is visible. The extent that all things are excitable by light and therefore manifest some subset of light, it could be said that things that manifest illumination are like Buddha nature. And that perhaps light is more like Buddha.
Or maybe we could say the light that's invisible of itself is like Buddha nature. We can't get a hold of that. And the things that it projects on, where we can see the projection of the light, is like manifestation of Buddha nature as a watch, or as appearance of a watch. You could play with it in different ways, but Buddha nature also cannot be seen directly, but the manifestations of Buddha nature can appear.
Evidence of, yeah.
And also the thing about excited, I think you said earlier something like the watch is exciting our Buddha nature, something like that. But from this more strictly speaking, from kind of mind-only perspective, we say that actually it's more like our mind is exciting the watch. It's like there's not really something out here that's starting the process back here. It's coming from this direction. It's coming from the mind direction. But in a way, mutual and inconceivable. But this is more like, the strict traditional mind-only thing where there's not even a basis. Gotten into this stuff before, and there's not actually like a watch that we can't see and we'll never see, but we can deduce is here because we're all looking at it like this. This strictly speaking mind only tradition says there's not a basis, not a material basis for a watch, that the basis itself is more layers of mind. There's nothing other than mind, but we don't need to go there today. Okay. Yes.
Amazing how practicing in this machine just animates so much the just relinquishing the normal patterns of mind. This whole world comes alive. It's ungraspable. It really feels like a wall of self. That was the whole line.
Yeah. It's true, Sashin is a great gift that way. Our perception of things is a little bit different, and things are more light, and sometimes they're like, it feels like we feel freer sometimes because it's like we see so much of like this kind of real thing that I'm grasping, is like I just can't grasp it in the way I usually do it quite as much. But sometimes I think it gets magnified even more. Like a little thing can like blow up to be this, a huge issue because the mind is so like alive and active now. It's kind of like, I think sometimes it can go that way too. But everything is more workable and flexible, it seems. And it can shift from like a huge, massive problem about to like crush me to like, oh, where was it again? Pretty quickly. And then back again. Like, oh, there it is. Yeah. Whereas things don't shift so quickly maybe in our usual life outside of Sesshin. Because maybe we're not as present. We kind of drag the present into the future. It leaves this kind of like long, slimy trail. And it's a sheen, it's like a slug. It's a sheen, it doesn't leave as much of a trail. It's like riding on water, it's gone. So just to finish this little section. So as for all sentient beings, in the Buddha way, all things possessed of mind are called sentient beings because mind is, as such, sentient being. Things not possessed of mind are also sentient beings because sentient beings are, as such, mind. So he's kind of redefining in, you know, this would, a sutra wouldn't do this, but in Dogen playing, saying, this is kind of a living being because it is mind. That's the way I hear it. Hence, all mind is, let's say, living being. And living beings are all being Buddha nature. So now we're going to bring in this, we have these three things now. Mind, living beings, and Buddha nature. And we already know that mind and Buddha nature are these, you know, Buddha nature is the true aspect, true nature of mind, and of living beings. But now that we've discovered that watches are living beings and mind, therefore they are also being Buddha nature. Grass and trees, nations and states are mind. Because they are mind, they are living being. Because they are living being, they are being Buddha nature. Sun, moon, stars, and planets are mind. Because they are mind, they are living being. Because they are living being, they are being Buddha nature. The being Buddha nature uttered by national teacher Juran is just like this. If it were not like this, it would not be the being Buddha nature that is uttered in the Buddha way. So, therefore, that's I really appreciate that section from, you know, as a little comment on all the all our mind-only discussions, that grass, trees, and land, stars, planets, it's nice to, they always emphasize, not just the things on this earth, but like as far out as we can possibly experience. And we don't say outside our experience. If there's some planet that's no one has ever discovered and ever seen or experienced, maybe we'd say that planet actually is not mind and does not have Buddha nature. How about that? Yeah, and that no one's. Yeah. Yeah, that no one's. Yeah, because I think if we can have a like if astrophysicists have mathematically determined that there is some planet that but we can't see it through any telescopes or anything, but we can deduce that it's there and imagine that it's there. Yeah, I think we could say that then it's mind, and therefore is being Buddha nature. But if we haven't even imagined it, I think that's the difference, right?
So it seems for the practitioner, mm-hmm. for the simple pastoral monk, not the guy in the college.
The nostrils.
For some simple nostrils.
The guy with nostrils, the breathing back. But that guy, ultimately, everything comes down to silence, and it's just a matter of the quality of formation, of the quality of intention that's being formed. Whether it's whether it really is intention, say towards compassion for all beings, intentions that are articulated by our vows, as opposed to the opposite of our vows. Some of us come from that place. So practice then, quite apart from all these different words, is the most important thing, as the way in which we form our intentions. And that the ability to form intention may be the bulk of what we are involved in when we consider Buddha nature.
That's a major aspect of a living being, is forming intentions. And as we talked about, someone, we talked about karma and intention, that if we look really close, we can see that there's no actual I that's forming them, but there is the forming of intentions. Intentions are formed every moment. And you could say in Sesshin and in Zazen, we're just carefully watching, paying attention to the way that intentions are formed. And like here, I feel the intention, the vow to enter all Dharma gates is wow, that just formed. Let's nurture that. Then we, you know, that thought arises, and then another intention to nurture that vow comes, and then another intention comes to, like, I vow to not enter any more Dharma gates. It's been enough. And then this another little voice comes and says, no, it's okay. We're like, I'm open to some more.
But all that switchbacking is Buddha nature.
Yeah. Yeah, all of that activity of mind is, maybe we say, manifesting Buddha nature. Because we have to remember this kind of difficult problem that Dogen also left us with when he said, what was that part? The mistaken view that Buddha nature is identical to our present perceptions and discriminations. So, as we open it up more and more, everything's manifesting Buddha nature. We're left with this problem. Our present discriminating mind is actually not identical with Buddha nature. And maybe that's kind of strong language, implies the fact that maybe discriminating mind could be a manifestation of Buddha nature, and all our intentions and everything that's arising in our little sentient mind is all manifestations of Buddha nature. But to say it's all identical to Buddha nature as like vast empty awareness is maybe going too far.
I think the activity that he was talking about, as opposed to just Buddha.
Yeah, and maybe activity and manifestation seem very similar too, right? So we have, so sometimes Dogen's talking about Gen Busho, manifesting Buddha nature, which is maybe more like this activity. And then Buddha nature is like, it's so inconceivable that it's not even a matter of movement or stillness. But when it appears in movement and life and like zazen and joy and sadness and everything like that, then maybe we call it Gen Busho, like manifestation of Buddha nature. Because the nature of mind can manifest as basically anything.
Doesn't he say somewhere that Buddhas don't have Buddha nature?
I think, do we already get to that, or is that coming? I think that I do recall something like that. Yeah. Yes.
I guess I'm just getting a little bit confused, because when we chant...
You might be, but your Buddha nature's not.
Exactly. So, when we chant the metta sutta, we're chanting for near, far, visible, and invisible, born or to be born. And it seems like, if that's what we're chanting for, And that was a good sign that we haven't yet determined to go there.
Ah, to be born. Yeah, well, we're may they be happy, I mean, in that chant, right? And maybe we could interpret it as when they're born, may they be happy. Because before they're born, they actually don't need to be happy. They can't be unhappy. They're not suffering before they're born. The unborn does not suffer. But the born and the to be born, when they are born, may they be happy. So maybe we say they're not suffering and they don't have Buddha nature until they're born, and then they have Buddha nature and we wish them to be happy. You could say Buddha nature, we need Buddha nature in order to be happy and to be sad, that and to have those wishes are for beings with Buddha nature. Yeah. Visible or invisible, though, we do say, right? So that's a good point about if we've never seen them and we just imagine like hungry ghosts, we don't know if they exist or not in some invisible realm, but if they do, may they be happy. Does that make sense? I think we don't have to worry about the unborn. Unless it's like, there's already living life in a womb, for example, that's not yet like born out into the world. But we could say in a way, as soon as there's a tiny conception of a living being, that we call that born, actually. Mm-hmm. All-pervading, unlimited, yeah.
By our imagination.
Mm-hmm. We call it the four immeasurables, or the four unlimiteds: loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. It's like there's no boundaries or limits to that wish. Yeah. But then if we're into the technicality of, well, what the beings that are not yet born have Buddha nature. Maybe we just leave it as the unborn doesn't have Buddha nature, but Buddha nature is unborn. For the time being, is there even time being? The unborn seems like if there's a time being, there must be like it must be in the realm of birth and life, outside of life. Is there any time or being? So we'll probably have lunch coming soon. May our open heart and vow to be free and at ease with everyone be realized moment to moment. May we find our place in Sesshin when we get far off track and lose our way, may we quickly find it again. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions beings are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.